Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. More than 10 years ago, when my mother got the diagnosis that every woman dreads, that she had breast cancer, it was the most bewildering and traumatic moment of my life. About 20 years earlier, my mother's sister, my aunt, had died of breast cancer at the age of only 38. After the haze of emotions cleared from learning about my own mother's cancer, I searched for something to help make sense of what was happening, and I found Dr. Susan Love's breast book. Considered the foremost authority on breast cancer in the United States, Dr. Love wrote with clear-eyed explanations and helpful diagrams on how to understand the disease that has claimed so many women's lives and how far technology has advanced to treat it. Now, as we head into October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Dr. Susan Love has published the sixth and what she says is probably last edition of her breast book, exactly 25 years after its initial publication. Dr. Susan Love is a surgeon, researcher, mother, and author. She is the chief visionary officer of the Dr. Susan Love Research Foundation and a clinical professor of surgery at UCLA. She is the co-founder of the National Breast Cancer Coalition, and she now joins us today as part of our ongoing series on the science of health to discuss the sixth edition of Dr. Susan Love's breast book. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you, Sonali. Great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. My mother, I should say, is surviving.
Oh, good.
She has had various scares and various treatments and is undergoing chemotherapy for the third time right now. But it is under control. And I have to first ask you to tell me why. 25 years ago, you wrote this book because this book for me, and this whole conversation is really personal for me, it was a guiding light for me when I first learned about my mother's cancer. I have my third edition copy of your book, and it's, you know, underlined and dog-eared, and I spent a lot of time reading this book, and a lot of my understanding of this disease came from your book. So you're meeting somebody who you've personally touched.
Well, I'm glad I could be of help.
And so what was the main motivation for you to come up with essentially what's a handbook about understanding this organ in women's bodies?
Well, when I first wrote it it first came out in 1995, and those were the early days when we had just learned that lumpectomy and radiation was equal to mastectomy, that they were equivalent in terms of survival, they were equivalent in terms of local control, and yet the American surgeons were saying, no, you know, I don't think so. That data was done in Italy, that was Italian women, and Italian breast cancer, and it won't work in the United States. And women were really not being given their options. So the first edition was explaining why what you did surgically wasn't so important, and what you did in terms of chemo or hormones or other treatment was probably equally important. And then every 5 years I've updated it, and as I've updated it, things have changed, and things have been, you know, secondary treatments have become more important. Then we thought, well, chemo is really what's the most important, and we got to a point where we were giving high doses of chemo and bone marrow transplants so the woman could survive. And then we found out that wasn't any better. Then we moved to, well, it's targeted. You've got to get the exact right treatment to the kind of tumor it is. That was the last edition. But now what we've found is the tumor isn't homogeneous. It's not all the same. So you could have a lot of hormone positive cells and then also have a few cells that are not hormone positive. And when you get a recurrence or you get metastases, it doesn't always match the original tumor. So the hot new thing now is the immune system. Well, maybe if we unleash the immune system so that it actually recognizes cancer cells, it won't matter what kind they are. We'll see, but that's what this edition explains.
And so this is, of course, very confusing to the layperson, particularly somebody who's received the news either about themselves or somebody they love. And we sexualize breasts. We see them all over our billboards, but we still, I think, don't have a real understanding of, you know, what they do, how they function, what happens when tumors arise. And so the diagrams in your book I've always found were just really clear. I mean, these are not like your biology textbook diagrams. These are even clearer than that. I would almost call them infographics in our current day and age. Let's talk about the statistics. Breast cancer cancer is the most common cancer among women. Have rates of breast cancer increased over the past 25, 30 years? And do those numbers that we have today, do they depend on better detection methods, et cetera?
Well, that's exactly it. That yes, they've increased, but some of it is better is screening and better detection. So doing mammographic screening starting at 50 and in some places even earlier finds more cancers. Some of them may be not as relevant. Maybe they were never going to do anything anyway. I say it's sort of like the TSA. Not everybody who looks like a terrorist is a terrorist. And that's the way it is with some of these tumors that we find. But we do find more of them. And then also women are living longer than ever before. So they have more time to get cancer. Mm-hmm. And they're also having their pregnancies later. And we know that that increases the risk of breast cancer. So there's a combination of things which have increased it. What's actually decreased it since the last edition of the book is the data showing that taking hormones after menopause increased breast cancer. A lot of women stopped taking them, and the incidence after menopause went down immediately.
Wow. What about survival rates of among women who had cancer?
The survival rates are also improved. Some of them are improved because if we're treating things that were never going to go bad anyway, you know, it's again, if we go back to my terrace, if you find people, if you say, well, we stopped X number of people, but if half of them were never going to be terrorists in the first place, maybe you weren't doing so much good. So some of it is that, but some of it is better treatment, better targeted treatment, and better treatments in general. And the other thing, I think, which is one of the big major shifts since the last edition of the book, is metastatic disease, that we're doing a much better job when breast cancer shows up again. So what kills people with breast cancer are not breast cancer cells in their breast. They're when the cells get out of their breast to other more important organs. And
because you can survive without your breasts.
You can survive without your breasts, but you have a harder time without your brain or your lungs or your liver. And so we're better at treating that. And women who have metastatic breast cancer used to be, you know, quickly die of it. Now we can really treat it and maintain people for a fairly long period of time, depending on the kind of metastatic disease they have. So we have a lot more about metastatic disease in this edition than we had in the first edition, where I don't even think I talked about it very much.
So much has changed over the decades, which is why you've updated your editions. I want to talk about detection a little bit more, because that has seemed to be the sort of standard by which doctors and the medical establishment has approached breast cancer. Well, if we can detect them, then we can have the best odds of treating them and survival rates. And there have been a lot of technological strides on detection. If you're finding the cancers or tumors that may never kill you, then how does that change things? The Wall Street Journal had an article last year said some leading cancer experts say that zealous screening and advanced diagnostic tools are finding ever smaller abnormalities in prostate, breast, thyroid, and other tissues. Many are being labeled cancer or precancer and treated aggressively, even though they may have never caused harm. Can we do more harm by treating?
I think we can do more harm, and I think we do more harm, because one of the things that we don't talk about is the collateral damage of treatment.
Right.
Something I'm sure your mother knows all too well, that the treatment does not come without side effects and consequences. And so it's not like, oh, well, so what if we over-treat some people? There's going to be a real suffering based on that. So we need to be better. We've been in this place of early detection is the answer, and as long as we find it, we can cure it, and life will be great. But sometimes a lot of what we're finding, again, going back to the TSA, are really not going to be terrorists and are not going to be cancers. And so we need to be better at figuring out which ones matter and which ones don't.
Right.
In addition, I think, and this is something the Dr. Susan Love Research Foundation is focused on, we need to be better at maybe finding the cause and preventing it. Wouldn't it be better not, instead of waiting till it's cancer, figure out what the cause is? And people look at me and like I'm crazy, but in my professional lifetime, with cancer of the cervix, we went from initially doing hysterectomies if you had an abnormal pap smear because we didn't know what else to do and you lost your fertility. And then we figured out it was sexually transmitted, and then we figured out it was a virus, and now we have a vaccine. So we can prevent cancer of the cervix. Women used to lose their fertility to cancer of the cervix, and now they don't. We can do that with cancer of the breast if we figure out how does it start and what causes it. And we're working hard on that kind of research.
Right. So there is, of course, a certain segment of and a certain percentage of women who have the so-called breast cancer genes. And for a long time, it was thought that breast cancer was almost entirely genetic. Now we know that only a small percentage of women actually have the breast cancer gene. And I'd like to talk to you about that. But then what about all these other women? And then is it the nature versus nurture? So for those women who have the breast cancer gene, the likelihood of getting breast cancer in their lifetime is so high that some women are opting for preventative double mastectomies. Is that a sledgehammer to an ant?
Well, it is a sledgehammer to an ant, but it's when you don't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
And when you don't know what causes it and you don't know really realistically how to prevent it, then the only thing you have is cutting out normal body parts. And the gene not only increases breast cancer risk, but also ovarian cancer risk. So often having your ovaries out will reduce both your ovarian and breast cancer risk. And having your breasts off will reduce your breast cancer risk. Ideally, we'll figure it out so that we don't have to use a sledgehammer to kill the ants. And maybe we'll have a specific kind of treatment or even a way to fix genes that are abnormal.
And then what about the majority of women who don't have the gene, likely don't have the gene? Do you have a sense, just, you know, we have these pink ribbon campaigns and the Race for the Cure and the, you know, and all of these public awareness campaigns raise money for research. And do we have a sense from the research that we hope is being done of what causes cancer, breast cancer among women who don't have the gene?
We don't really know what causes it, and I think one of the problems is we haven't paid enough attention to the breast itself. We actually don't know the anatomy of the breast. We don't know how many holes there are in the nipple. We don't know where the ducts go, and breast cancer starts in the milk ducts, so it'd be kind of nice to know where they are. One of the research projects, again, we're working at the foundation is trying to map the anatomy of the breast. Then the breast is really, you know, it turns blood into milk. It's a pretty magical organ. But it's also involved in a lot of things. Could it be a bacteria or a virus? When they did the human microbiome project, they didn't look at the breast. I don't know. The breast is a sacred organ that doesn't get studied. And you could wax eloquent about all the reasons that might be. But here's an organ that does get sucked on by babies and lovers, and it probably has bacteria and viruses in it. And shouldn't we investigate that and see whether some are good and maybe some are not so good? And we're doing some research on that as well, trying to figure that out. Because if we don't understand the normal breast, we're never going to understand the abnormal breast.
I mean, when you put it that way, it just makes me stunned thinking about how little then has been done. Has the majority of the research focused on a small part of the question?
Well, that's always the case in research in general, that we have this balance between not wanting to have research and waste money on really crazy ideas, but by the same token, then ending up doing boring the same old things over and over again ideas. And we need something in between. And one of the reasons I started my research foundation is to have a vehicle to actually explore some of the more out there ideas that won't get funded by the normal mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Because they're too out there.
Yeah. One of the things that I think strikes women is a sense of helplessness, that there is this potential murderer lurking in their bodies that they have to worry about, do their monthly breast self-exams, and over the age of 40 or 50, getting their regular mammograms. And I remember when I first picked up your book 10 years ago, one of the things that really struck me was what I thought was a pretty radical radical notion. You wrote, I think it alienates women from their breasts instead of making them more comfortable with them, this idea of doing your own breast self-exams.
Well, sort of a search and destroy mission, you know, and then it's your fault. If you get breast cancer, it must be your fault because you didn't do breast self-exam well enough or have your mammogram regularly. And we really are good at guilt as women anyway. But actually, there, you know, some cancers are very slow growing, and there's time to find them on a mammogram or an exam. But some cancers are very fast growing, and you could be doing everything right, and it could still show up. And so we have to be careful about putting so much onus on women that they feel like they, like if they get breast cancer or if it's an aggressive breast cancer, somehow it's their fault and they did something wrong. Usually it's not their fault. It's usually much more a matter of the biology of the tumor and the fact that, and the really thing, the real fault, I would say, is in science that hasn't figured it out yet.
And so the onus is on women to, you know, to essentially check their if their own bodies are ready to murder them.
Yes. And I think that's crazy. Yeah. You know, the breast is a nice, friendly part of you, and we shouldn't make it into the enemy that's out to get you. Most people are not going to get breast cancer.
Right. And there's this amazing graphic that you have in your book, your latest edition. It's on page 153 of your book about the odds of surviving and just the odds in the general population. 200 women who don't have breast screening every 3 years from age 50 to 70. Of that, when you go through the diagram, 12 are diagnosed with breast cancer. Of them, 8 are treated and survive. 4 are treated but die. So out of 200 women who don't get screened, 4 treated but die. And then the 200 women who do have breast screening every 3 to 5 years from age 50 to 70, 15 diagnosed with breast cancer, 12 treated and survived, 3 treated but die. There's a difference of 1 out of 200 women between those who screen and don't screen.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, so those women who are not so careful about screening
shouldn't feel so guilty. That's exactly right. No, and the other downside of screening is extra biopsies because they find things they don't know what they are. You end up having a biopsy, then you get scared, and all, you know, it leads you down a path. Now, I think that we should be having screening after 50, that mammograms work best in women after 50, and I agree with the recommendations that we should have them regularly after 50. If you're high risk, you might want to consider something before that. But if you feel something that feels abnormal, you should get it checked out if you're either with a mammogram or with ultrasound. Ultrasound is very good at diagnosing, you know, lumps and bumps and abnormal areas. So I'm not saying, you know, never do touch your breast again or never get an exam again. But this idea that if we just screen more people and start earlier, we'll solve it is not the answer. The answer is what's the cause and how can we end it?
So there is a sense, particularly among people who are skeptical of modern medicine, that cancer treatment is all this big conspiracy designed to enrich hospitals and that cancer can, in fact, either be prevented by diet or, when you have it, be treated by so-called alternative therapies or even by diets. And I'm sure you've come across this sentiment. I know my mother wouldn't be alive if it weren't for chemotherapy and radiation. How do you respond to this sense?
Well, I think that as with everything, there's a grain of truth, but it's not totally true. Mm-hmm. So the answer is that to have cancer, you need two things. You need mutated cells, and they need to be in a neighborhood that's egging them on. So you need both. The chemotherapy is really good at killing mutated cells, but the neighborhood is something that you can control a little bit, not entirely, with diet, exercise, stress reduction, a lot of things that we sometimes consider alternative.
So this is the immune system part of the story.
It's the immune system, it's the sort of metabolism, it's a lot of those kinds of factors. So I do think that diet and exercise, stress reduction are important adjuncts. But if you already have a terrorist or, you know, somebody who's in your house with a machine gun, then, you know, just singing Kumbaya is not going to get rid of them. You got to both blast the cancer cells and then change the neighborhood. So you don't get more.
Right. So how important is it to educate the public about breast cancer? And your organization, the Research Foundation, has done a lot of work on this. And the books that you've written, of course, contribute to that greatly. But to put when you put things in perspective, we don't, you know, in the 15 minutes we get with our doctor, we don't get the chance to explore all of these issues and put them in perspective that living a healthy life overall is really great. You know, zealous screening may not improve your odds by very much. How important is it for the public to know about
this? Well, I think it's very important because I think we've gotten down to doing things in sound bites, and the trouble with sound bites is most of this stuff is nuanced, and you can't express it in a sound bite. On the foundation, we have a new program called Inpatient Science, and we have videos, short videos, that will explain things to people. That will explain in a short video what is metastatic disease, what does it mean, what is a new diagnosis, what are the steps. And as things evolve, we also have blogs that explain science in general and a website that will explain things. Because my mission in life is to be an explainer. I'm a good explainer. I'm the oldest sister of five, and I've been explaining my whole life. And I think the concepts are not that complicated, as we found today in this great interview. The concepts aren't that complicated. It's just that when we use all these fancy words, we make them sound complicated.
Right.
But really, it's not that bad. And so this new program, Inpatient Science, we hope will be a new way to really give people better understanding of what's going on.
And since your first edition came out, the internet has exploded.
Exactly.
The downside of that is that everybody is Dr. Google.
Yep.
And, you know, people can scare themselves silly from, you know, looking online for information. And generally, you know, you can basically diagnose yourself with anything if you look hard enough.
And you don't know who really is telling you and who's giving you this advice and what kind of, you know, what their angle is and what their background is. Yeah, I thought about before I wrote this new edition, because it's such a big ordeal to do, I thought about, do we really need it anymore? And then I realized, no, you really need a reference so that you can take what you're seeing on the internet and then put it into some context. Because without the context and the explanations, it really becomes all fear and no understanding.
Yeah. You've battled cancer yourself.
I did.
Acute myeloid leukemia. Can you share your personal journey with
us? Yeah, it was about 3 years ago, and I actually was feeling fine. I had gone for a run the night before, and I had a routine blood test, and I got a call saying, come right back. You have, you know, abnormal cells in your blood. And I had leukemia, and it's a very aggressive kind, and so I went right into the hospital and had chemotherapy. And then had a bone marrow transplant from my younger sister.
Wow.
And now 3 years later, I'm good. You know, it's the one cancer that is not surgical. So I actually didn't know anything about it because I'm a surgeon and I've never dealt with leukemia. So you never get what you know about. It taught me a lot of things. And one of the things it taught me is that the doctor compares you to the people who died. And so they're patting themselves on the back for having done such a good job keeping you alive. You compare yourself to how you were before. And you are acutely aware of the price you've paid to be here. It's not that you aren't happy to be here, but the chemo brain, the neuropathy, the joint pains, the you know, all of these things, which are side effects and often permanent side effects, I call them collateral damage from the treatment, are real. And I think we haven't paid enough attention to that. So we just look at the numbers, and if we have more people living, we pat ourselves on the back, and we don't pay attention to how the treatments we've given them have really impacted their lives, which is considerable. And I think more research into that would help us sometimes avoid it, or, you know, maybe there are some people who are more prone to some complications than others, and we could figure that out and then pick our drugs using that information. Right. But that kind of research hasn't been done.
Quality of life is really important.
It's very important. And particularly if you don't know how long your life is going to be, you would really like it to be as good as you can.
Can you give out websites for where people can find your work online? And of course, they can pick up copies of your latest edition, Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book, at their local bookstore, but online?
Online. You can also get it on Kindle, for your Kindle or electronically. And the website is drsusanloveresearch.org.
And we'll post that to our website. drsusanloveresearch.org can be found at uprisingwithsonali.com later today. Dr. Love, thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Susan Love, a surgeon, researcher, mother, and author, chief visionary officer of the Dr. Susan Love Research Foundation, clinical professor of surgery at UCLA, co-founder of the National Breast Cancer Coalition. You can pick up the sixth edition of Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book at your local bookstore.